Reveal is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today, we want to look back at the movie that got journalists excited this past year, Spotlight. It's a blockbuster movie about the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal, and it won the Academy Award for Best Picture. The movie focuses on the Boston Globe's investigative team that exposed a massive cover-up. Today, we're going to take you behind the scenes of that investigation and look at the legacy of the Boston Globe's first groundbreaking story and how other journalists would expose crimes by Catholic priests around the world. Before we get started, there are a few things we should let you know. When we first ran this piece earlier this year, it had some pretty graphic content. So if you get triggered by this type of material or have young children, you should probably tune out now. The film begins in 2001. Marty Baron has just taken over as the editor of the Boston Globe, and he issued a challenge to the paper's investigative team, known as Spotlight. Liev Schreiber plays Baron in the movie.
We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges.
These guys are Catholic priests who sexually abuse children. The paper wanted to find out whether top church leaders were involved in a cover-up.
Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
Sounds like we're going after Law.
Law is Cardinal Bernard Law, the head of the Boston Archdiocese. And the reporters did find evidence that it came from the top down, that the church had paid hush money to quietly settle child molestation claims against priests. Here's actor Mark Ruffalo as Boston Globe reporter Mike Resendiz.
We got Law. This is it.
No, this is Law covering for one priest. There's another 90 out there.
The reporter wants to rush to press, but his editor, played by Michael Keaton, tells him to keep digging.
Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get Law. This is Law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then things get pretty heated.
We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
At the end of the film, it's January 2002. The Boston Globe has just published a front page story revealing the scandal. The story focuses on former priest John Gagan, sexually abused over 130 children. The reporters on the Spotlight team come into the newsroom. Their phones are ringing off the hook as new leads come pouring in from around the city, and the credits roll. But that's just the beginning. Now we're going to tell you what happened next and how over the next several months, the Globe's reporting would shake up the leadership of the Catholic Church. The real-life editor of the Spotlight team, Walter Robbie Robinson, picks up where the movie ends.
We had the church's records, which showed definitively that Cardinal Law and his lieutenants and prior cardinals knew explicitly what Gagan had done and had transferred him from parish to parish, often without telling the new receiving pastor about his past history abusing children.
Spotlight reporters tried to get Cardinal Law to answer questions about Gagan, but he refused. In fact, a spokeswoman for Law told the reporters that they weren't even interested in knowing what the questions would be. But after the initial stories were published, people in Boston and around the country put pressure on the church. Cardinal Law could no longer stay silent.
Please pray for all those who have been victimized as minors by clergy, as well as for their families.
My memory of that press conference, it's the first time that the cardinal spoke.
Pray that those responsible may come to conversion of heart and self-awareness before God. We are trying to do the best we can.
The cardinal was quite defensive.
Pray for the hundreds of faithful priests of this archdiocese who bear with me the burden of a few. With all my heart, I wish to apologize once again for the harm done to victims of sexual abuse by priests.
The cardinal apologized, but in a way that it wasn't an apology so much as an explanation.
Judgments were made regarding the assignment of John Gagan, which, in retrospect, were tragically incorrect. These judgments were, however, made in good faith and in reliance upon psychiatric assessments and medical opinions that such assignments were safe and reasonable.
And within 2 or 3 days, we reported a story that the two doctors he was referring to, one was the family general practitioner for Gagan, the other was a psychiatrist at a Catholic hospital whose specialty was not child abuse and who himself had been accused of sexually abusing women patients.
Cardinal Law went from being one of the most powerful and revered religious figures in the country to being the focus of protesters gathered outside of the church headquarters, clutching signs and shouting,
"Stop the madness!"
Now he should be in jail.
The second major wave to crash on shore was a story in late January in which we reported that the Archdiocese had made secret settlements to keep accusations quiet about 70 priests over the prior decade or two. Within a year later, we found out it was close to 250 total priests who had been credibly accused of molesting children.
And as the information came out, so did calls for Law to step down. As a prince of the church, he answered to the Pope, and only the Pope could accept his resignation.
And I think that it would not serve that cause of protecting children if I were at this point to submit my resignation.
Cardinal Law, had he been the head of any other institution, probably would not have lasted a month, but because he was a prince of the church and the most senior American cardinal, he managed to survive for months and months.
Another Globe reporter, Kevin Cullen, joined the Spotlight team after the first stories broke. He says a scandal started affecting the church's bottom line.
Donations to the church's good works just went through the floor. A lot of people I know, people in my family, stopped giving money. They weren't going to give money to the church's good works as long as Law remained there.
People began to distance themselves from the cardinal, and calls for his resignation intensified. Spotlight editor Robbie Robinson says Cardinal Law's power and influence in Boston began to disappear.
Like a small block of ice on a hot July day. It went away so quickly. The church in Boston lost its political clout almost entirely and almost immediately.
Lawsuits were filed by victims, a grand jury was convened, and thousands more documents from church files were made public.
One thing we saw in the files we received from the church is that consistently the church was more sympathetic for accused priests than for victims.
Sasha Pfeiffer, played by Rachel McAdams in the film, one of the four original Spotlight reporters who broke the story.
We would see these letters that would say, "Oh, dear Jack," which is what they called John Gagan, Father John Gagan. "Dear Jack, we're very sorry you're having to go through this hard time."
And it was in their own words. It wasn't what the Globe said. It's what Cardinal Law and everybody else in the Archdiocese said. We were just printing what they said, and it was damning.
You know, when we first got ready to publish, we were concerned that there may be demonstrators or protesters or picketers outside the Globe when they saw our first story. And we were stunned that there was none of that. In fact, there was so much anger instead directed at the church.
It was a sea change. It just changed the way people looked at their church and particularly at their cardinal and their archbishop. It just changed everything.
So maybe 4 months after we published our first stories, many other newspapers and media outlets around the country were doing their own investigations and finding the same thing in their communities. Consistently, anytime another media outlet has taken a close look at a major diocese, they found the same approach of covering up cases of abuse, shuffling abusive priests from parish to parish. So this became a national story and then an international story. We now know that the same thing occurred in Europe and South America and other parts of the world.
In Boston, the pressure on cardinal law kept mounting. The cardinals' apologies continued, and as time passed, they came with fewer explanations, fewer justifications. 10 months after the first story broke, Law showed more emotion when he addressed his own congregation and said,
"I stand before you with a far deeper awareness of this terrible evil."
What I remember most about the cardinal is that there was really an air of resignation in his voice when he spoke publicly about this after not very much time into the year. He was a weary, weary man, beaten down by this.
A group of priests from Boston took the unheard-of step of calling for his resignation.
After all those stories and all the attention, he had to go. It finally became obvious. You're not going to get anybody in the Vatican to admit that the Boston Globe drove the cardinal out of Boston, but that's generally how most people would perceive it.
In December of 2002, 11 months after the first spotlight story ran, Cardinal Bernard Law flew to Rome and handed his resignation to Pope John Paul II. Soon after, a Boston church spokesperson announced,
"The cardinal is profoundly grateful to the Holy Father for having accepted his request to resign as archbishop."
I think Cardinal Law's resignation was clearly a result of the Globe's reporting. On the other hand, he was transferred to Rome, where he was given a new job that many people considered almost a promotion.
In May of 2004, the Pope appointed Law to one of the most prestigious churches in Rome, St. Mary Major Basilica, where Law went on to officiate at church ceremonies amid ornate trappings.
And Cardinal Law went on to live the life, the very much coddled life of a prince of the church in Rome. He had a cook, he had a fabulous residence, and we reported he had a 10,000 euro a month allowance.
It really frosted me to see that he was basically rewarded when he got back to Rome. It's not like he was being, you know, cast out. It's just the opposite. He was welcomed almost as a company guy that did the right thing. Yeah, I don't think it's any surprise that he ended up in Vatican City at the end of all this, in case anybody else wanted to, you know, bring him back and depose him for other cases.
Well, the cover-up extended all the way to and including the Vatican. Every archbishop and cardinal that we knew of, or that we found out about, both in the United States and elsewhere, had done the same thing to greater or lesser degrees in their own archdioceses.
Like every story in history, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. I'm sorry, if the most higher-up people in the Vatican, including the Pope, didn't know about this, or can sit there with a straight face and say they didn't know how bad this was, then, you know, I don't think they've changed at that level at all. I still think there's quite a bit of denial there.
I think the fact that very few top church officials have ever had to face any kind of criminal charge is, of course, disappointing to victims, but also maybe telling of how the church views this. I mean, certainly we hear publicly the church say that this was incredibly wrong, and I do believe that many church officials believe that. But at some level, there still hasn't been accountability.
That was Sasha Pfeiffer, Kevin Cullen, and Walter Robbie Robinson of the Boston Globe Spotlight Investigative Reporting Team. The Boston Globe won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on the scandal in the Catholic Church, and the film Spotlight won 2 Academy Awards this year for Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay. In the spirit of full disclosure, one of the producers of Spotlight is on the board of the Center for Investigative Reporting. And a footnote, the church has paid victims hundreds of millions of dollars in financial settlements, leading 12 major archdioceses in the U.S. to declare bankruptcy. The most recent one was in Minnesota. And that's where we're going next, to the Twin Cities, where a whistleblower exposed how the church was hiding clergy sex abuse from the public. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today, we're talking about what happened after the Boston Globe broke the story of sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests in 2002. As a reminder, today's show is not appropriate for young listeners. The Globe's reporting put tremendous pressure on Catholic bishops throughout the United States. Archbishop Harry Flynn of St. Paul led the church's response to the scandal. He addressed his fellow bishops at a conference in Dallas that summer.
This is a defining moment for us this morning as bishops. A moment for us to declare our resolve once and for all to put a plan in place and to commit ourselves to that plan so as to root out a cancer in our church.
Archbishop Flynn headed a committee that drafted a national policy on clergy sexual abuse called the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. It promised zero tolerance of abusive priests. The media hailed it as a historic document.
After much forceful debate, a new plan to rid the church of abusers. The bottom line, for even a single act of sexual abuse of a minor, past, present, or future, the offending priest or deacon will not remain in ministry.
But after the conference ended, the cover-ups continued, and so did the reporting by news organizations around the country. And in 2013, more than a decade after the Boston Globe's original investigation, Minnesota Public Radio exposed another scandal. Reporter Madeline Barron spent 2 years looking into the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis and uncovered how the church was secretly making payments to abusers and continuing to conceal clergy sexual abuse from the public, all the while claiming to be national leaders in protecting children.
Hail Mary, full of grace.
The Catholic Church is everywhere you turn in the Twin Cities. The Cathedral of St. Paul dominates the skyline. The street that leads to the state capitol is named after the Archbishop, who built the church here a century ago.
Like many Catholics, when we're at Mass, my mind still defaults towards the part in the Eucharistic prayer where we pray for our bishop.
John, our bishop. And all those who holding to the truth...
That's Jennifer Hasselberger. She grew up going to Mass at St. Casimir's Parish on St. Paul's east side.
I still hear the priests of my childhood saying, John R. Roach, our bishop.
You can probably already tell that Jennifer's a devout Catholic. When I meet her for an interview, she's wearing a matching blazer and skirt, high heels, shoulder-length blonde hair, very professional-looking. She's precise about what she wears and what she says. And the other thing about her... She loves rules and wants to make sure people follow them. She went to school to become a canon lawyer, an expert on Catholic Church law.
I took a job in the church because I wanted to do good and live out my faith.
In 2008, she took a job as a top advisor to John Nienstedt, who was archbishop at the time. She was also in charge of the records department. The archdiocese had already dealt with priests who'd been accused of sexually abusing kids, and they kept files on all of them.
When I started, the priest files were just, they were just an absolute mess. So you'd have a manila folder, and you'd have everything kind of stuffed in there from mimeograph papers from way back to, you know, copies of letters to memos, just all in this kind of mad jumble, no order whatsoever. So, you know, it was almost a Herculean task to find out anything in any of these files.
The files weren't just disorganized. They were incomplete. Jennifer and her staff scoured the Archdiocese headquarters looking for the missing files. They discovered that someone had stored them away in stacks of banker's boxes in the basement.
So when I learned that that had happened, I had the staff attempt to locate and collect all of that information and bring it back up into the light of day, if you will.
Jennifer set up a color-coded system for the files. She had her staff create green binders for the regular personnel files kept on every priest, and red binders for the documents related to allegations of sexual abuse and other misconduct.
It was always a sad thing for me to have to ask my staff to do that, because when you're getting into the red files, there was just a lot of information about a lot of really sad circumstances and a lot of bad behavior and a lot of ways that the church had failed to adequately respond to it. And so, you know, it was always with a good deal of sadness that I'd have to kind of ask people to work through that.
When Jennifer took the job, she knew she'd have to confront some pretty upsetting details about sex crimes in the church. But she wasn't expecting what she found. Not a single priest accused of sexually assaulting children had been defrocked, meaning the Archdiocese hadn't asked the Vatican to kick out a single one.
I was absolutely shocked. As long as these men remain priests, the Archdiocese remains liable for them. So when you're given an opportunity, and there's, you know, such clear evidence of guilt, of such horrific crimes, to not kind of take the opportunity of getting this resolved, to me that was just mind-boggling.
She was even more surprised to find that some priests who had admitted to sexually assaulting children were still working in parishes or in other jobs that gave them contact with children. That was in violation of the church's very public pledge of zero tolerance. She kept telling Archbishop Nienstedt and his top advisors what she was finding. She urged them to either make sure the abusive priests were kept far away from children or ask the Vatican to kick them out.
And what I found so frustrating about it is that I would have these conversations and I would tell people that, you know, we had to be concerned and not get any traction.
Month by month, Jennifer's frustrations grew. She spent a lot of time arguing with Nienstedt's top deputy, Father Peter Laird.
And I remember, you know, one night in particular, it being after hours and me going to Father Laird's office with a file regarding a priest and him turning around and actually looking at me because he had been working on his computer and his back turned to me initially and saying, "Do you think we have priests in ministry now that have sexually abused children?" And, you know, I thought about that, you know, long and hard. Is that actually my assessment? And I said, yes. And he just turned around and went back to typing at his computer.
Finally, in early 2013, Jennifer decided to resign. And a few months later, she called Minnesota Public Radio. She wanted to go public.
Because I was still having to look people in the face who I knew that I had information that they needed or they would want to have. You know, the fact that I had this and they didn't and no one was going to be telling them, it was really difficult.
In our first conversation, I remember thinking, if what she says is true, this is a huge and important story. No one at such a high level in any diocese in the Catholic Church in the United States had ever come forward to reveal an ongoing cover-up of clergy sex abuse. So I started meeting up with Jennifer at her house, and we spent hours talking. She told me that she found some new disturbing information about a notorious parish priest named Robert Capone. He was also an entertainer who went by the nickname Polka Padre.
I've got a never-ending love for you. From now on, that's all I want to do. From the first time we met, I knew.
That's Capone singing on his album, All-Time Polka Greats. The media would rename Polka Padre the Polka Predator. In the late 80s and early 90s, young men came forward to sue him and the Archdiocese for sexual abuse they say they suffered as children. One of them, Dale Scheffler, testified that when he was 13, The priest had taken him on an overnight trip to his lakeside home. Dale said the priest rubbed up against him in the lake while they were swimming. And that night, Dale recalled, he woke up in pain and realized the priest was trying to rape him. Capone admitted to abusing some boys, but not Dale Scheffler. Outside the courtroom, Dale begged then-Archbishop Harry Flynn to take Capone and other abusive priests out of ministry.
I come here today to ask you to please remove him. How can you go on living and knowing that they're doing this? Please, I'm asking you to remove these people, to remove all these priests that are doing this to these kids that are getting hurt.
Later that day, Archbishop Flynn removed Capone from his parish. The jury awarded Dale Scheffler a $1 million verdict, but a higher court ruled the statute of limitations had run out, so Dale got nothing. As for Capone, he went on to lead a quiet life in retirement until Jennifer Hasselberger came across his name during an audit of the Archdiocese finances.
Some of these cases were just egregious. I mean, the case of Father Robert Capone.
Jennifer found the Archdiocese wasn't just giving Capone a standard monthly pension. It was also giving him secret extra payments of $957 a month. Those extra payments from 1998 to 2012 added up to more than $160,000.
So what we were providing to Capone was in excess of what we were providing to those many priests who have done nothing but well by the faithful of this archdiocese.
And at least five other priests accused of sexual misconduct had also received extra money.
I was so angry. Up until that point, I had been someone who had contributed to the archdiocesan appeal. And to see my money, as well as everybody else's, put to such dishonorable use was very difficult.
Jennifer also came across a memo written by a top church deputy to Archbishop Harry Flynn, the bishop who led the Catholic Church's response to the earlier scandal in Boston. The official described what he called Capone's stunningly beautiful home that he had inherited from his parents. He listed off the number of rooms and their sizes. It's 600 feet of waterfront. And he wrote, "I mention this in order to assure you that Robert Capone is exceptionally well provided for in regard to his daily living situation." Capone was supposed to be monitored, but the memo revealed that no one started monitoring him until 8 years after his trial.
You know, it's kind of burned in my brain, as many of these things are, because Capone is supposed to be living a life of prayer and penance. And I couldn't, and I still cannot reconcile how a man who's supposed to be doing penance for the egregious sins that he committed, not to mention the crimes, but just the egregious sins, is vacationing in Venice, Florida, and living in a stunningly beautiful lake home, the actual site of all of these, of many of these acts of abuse.
Capone still lives on the same secluded lakefront property where he abused young boys. I went there to talk to him and found him taking care of some yard work. He jumped off the lawnmower when he saw me.
What can I do for you?
He was a trim 74-year-old with a full head of white hair, wearing dark sunglasses. Because of his history of abuse, he was supposed to be carefully monitored by the Archdiocese. I asked him about that.
Do you have any contact with the Archdiocese still?
About once a month. Uh-huh.
Okay. So does someone come visit you, or how does that work?
Well, not really. We just get together, you know, at different times.
So is it who? So it's someone?
But I just meet with a priest that I want to, up here or wherever.
Is it that monitoring program?
No.
Okay. So it's just someone you meet with for...
I just discuss, you know, news and happenings in the world and so on.
So what Capone is saying is that no one is making sure he's staying away from kids. At his trial, Capone testified about what he described as a 13-year struggle with sexual compulsions toward young boys. He claimed to have been cured by God. Capone now says the allegations he abused boys were exaggerated.
It's it's a difficult thing to explain, you know. I just don't care to get into that. That's all past.
But if someone were to say that you did it, would you say, no, that's not true?
Some of it.
Capone wouldn't explain what he meant by that. So despite his admission that he did abuse some boys, he's still a priest. But he's not allowed to serve in a parish. He says he lives alone and no longer has contact with children.
Any regrets at all about your time as a priest?
No, not at all. No. No, I felt I was called by God, and I believe I served him well.
Do you think about those days very often?
No, I don't. No. I'm very, very happy, and I'm a classical pianist, and just enjoy it. I go out to lunch in town and come back and pray.
Capone still receives his pension, but Jennifer, the whistleblower, made sure his extra payments of nearly $1,000 a month were cut off. She says she's angry and sad about the cover-up, but her faith hasn't been shaken. Still, she feels relieved to no longer be a part of the church hierarchy.
Mainly, I just had the sense that I could finally look people in the eye again. That all the shame of having been a part of that for so long, I could set that aside.
Jennifer had hoped a grand jury would be convened to consider criminal charges against individual church officials. She believed only the threat of prison would convince church leaders to stop covering up abuse. Regardless of whether that happens, Jennifer says church leaders will eventually have to face what they've done.
As Catholics, even if it doesn't happen in this life, we know it will in the next. There'll be a reckoning.
But that reckoning Jennifer is looking for hasn't happened yet. It's been more than 2 years since Minnesota Public Radio first reported this story, and not one church official has been charged in the cover-up. Not one. In June of 2015, criminal charges were filed against the Archdiocese for failing to protect children. This summer, the charges were dropped after the Archdiocese admitted wrongdoing and agreed to regular reviews of its child protection protocols. As for Jennifer's old boss, Archbishop Neinstedt, he did have to answer questions under oath as a part of a lawsuit brought by a victim. An attorney asked him about the list, the one the Archdiocese kept of priests accused of sexually abusing children.
From 2008 until 2013, you made the choice to keep that list secret, did you not?
It already had been kept secret, and I didn't see any reason to disclose.
Hundreds of other victims have come forward, threatening lawsuits. The Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis responded by filing for bankruptcy last year. A few months later, Archbishop Neinstedt resigned. We want to thank Madeline Baran and her team at Minnesota Public Radio for this story. They received a prestigious Peabody Award for their reporting on the Catholic Church scandal. And by the way, they just wrapped up a new podcast called In the Dark that investigates how police handled an infamous child abduction case in the 80s. You should definitely check it out. But coming up next, we hear how the church is sending priests to remote areas of South America after they've been accused of abusing children here, and they're still working with children. This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. This week, we're revisiting stories that show what happened after the Boston Globe first broke the story of Catholic priests abusing children. Now, earlier, we learned how accused priests were routinely moved from parish to parish in the U.S. But now we're finding they've also been moved to parishes in poor, remote corners of the developing world. And it's still happening. A Global Post reporting team investigated these fugitive fathers. We want to remind you that today's show includes some explicit descriptions of abuse, something to consider if you're with sensitive listeners. We start with the story of Father Francisco Montero, a native of Ecuador. In 2002, he took a position at the Incarnation Catholic Church in Minneapolis. A quick talker with an easy smile, Father Freddy, as he became known, charmed the local Hispanic population. But 5 years later, Father Freddy was arrested and accused of abusing a 4-year-old girl. David Joles is that girl's father.
I couldn't imagine that a Catholic priest, you know, could do something like that, could be interested in a child. And, you know, I had a hard time wrapping my head around it. And it took me a while to get angry because I was just, it was like out of nowhere.
A forensic psychologist with Child Protective Services interviewed the girl and concluded that she was a victim of sexual assault. It's hard to hear what the girl's dad says happened.
I know one time she told me that he rubbed his wiener on me. You know, what do you say as a father to your kid when she, you know, says something like that to you?
But sex crimes aren't just hard to prove. They're hard to prosecute. Officials didn't have enough evidence on Father Freddy, so they let him go. And almost immediately, Father Freddy left Minnesota for good. He flew back to his home country, Ecuador, and his old diocese welcomed him back. They even let him work with children, something David Joles just can't fathom.
Makes me really angry, and I think it's pathetic, you know, to think that what happened was so unimportant to the archdiocese that they didn't even bother defrocking the guy.
Meaning he was still allowed to work as a priest. Global Post correspondent Will Carlos spent months investigating similar cases of priests accused of abuse who were sent to Latin America. Will picks up the story for us in the mountain passes of Ecuador, where Father Freddy was hiding in plain sight.
Okay, so what we're finding each time we track one of these priests down is that they're really out there. They've really isolated themselves. I mean, we're in the middle of the Ecuadorian mountains right now. No cell phone service, very little internet.
And we're here, we're going down this one road that leads to Las Naves, and we get to this bridge, which is only wide enough for one car to come across at a time. And coming towards us is this truck. Now, I've had this grainy black and white postage stamp photo of Father Freddy. And as this truck comes towards us, I catch a glimpse of the driver. And I turn to my cameraman and I say, I think that's Father Freddy.
That's him.
Where?
I just saw him come down the street.
He's driving this red pickup truck stuffed with these teenagers, boys and girls, returning from this soccer tournament. And I run up to him.
Hi, Father Freddy. Freddy Montero, hi.
I don't remember you.
No, I haven't met you before. My name is Will Carlos. I'm a journalist with the Global Post. I'm actually here. We were hoping to do an interview with you.
About?
So yeah, even after months of planning and research and going through all the various different things that could happen in these interviews, actually confronting these guys face to face is never easy.
Well, it's about, we're doing a story about priests who abused or were accused of abusing children in the United States and are now working in South America.
And Father Freddy understandably didn't want to talk to me, but he agrees to give us a few minutes. And so we walk a little way away from the teenagers and we start to talk.
¿Y entonces, los acusaciones?
So are the accusations true or not?
There was an accusation, but no proof.
But did you do it?
No. Not every accusation is true. There are many people who are accused and sometimes convicted that were falsely accused.
We know that the Archdiocese in Minneapolis was worried enough about Freddy Montero that they sent this report detailing his accusations to both the Vatican and the diocese in Ecuador, where he ended up resettling. So we called the bishop who was in charge when Montero arrived, and he's since stepped down, but he said that he considered Montero to be innocent since no actual charges were ever filed against him. So I asked Father Freddy, how is it possible he could still have been working as a priest?
Okay.
So after returning, you re-entered the priesthood?
After some time, we talked and determined that I would assume a role in a particular place.
Okay.
So Father Freddy told me the local church leadership had let him work in a series of remote parishes in Ecuador since he'd arrived back in 2007. And he added that he recently decided to stop working as a priest, but not because of pressure from his superiors, but because he had political ambitions. He wanted to run for mayor of Las Naves. Now, as for the church taking action against him, Montero said he was never investigated, not by anyone, either in Ecuador or by the Vatican. And no one has contacted you?
No, no one has contacted me.
So with that, the former priest and accused child abuser honked goodbye and drove off with his truck full of kids.
to hear that he continues to be the free man and around kids makes me sick, and it makes me scared.
So back in the US now, that's Jeff Anderson. He's a lawyer in Minneapolis who represents child victims of priests, including the little girl who Father Freddie allegedly abused.
In the U.S., a law enforcement can go into just about any jurisdiction, but once they go outside of the U.S., it's really hard to prosecute, to expose, and to extradite an offender or anybody that's complicit in those offenses. And so that is the ultimate geographical solution, international movement of offenders in complete secrecy.
Complete secrecy. And the church wasn't just moving priests from the United States either. We also found this Belgian priest who transferred to Brazil 2 decades ago while facing child sexual abuse accusations at home. So that's where we went next, to go and find Father Jan van Dyl. A Dutch investigative news program, Brandpunt, interviewed people who said Father van Dyl had molested them as young boys, as far back as the 1980s.
He always grabbed my pants. He was always with his hands in my pants. He comes into your life, getting closer and closer.
Father Jan says he's never molested anyone. But according to Brazilian prosecutors, he's been under investigation by Belgian and Brazilian law enforcement for years, though he's never been formally charged with a crime. And in Brazil, we found out that he's facing new accusations of abuse. So we tracked down Van Dyl celebrating Mass in a small, sunny church in Caucaia, an impoverished coastal city up in northeastern Brazil. So the 76-year-old priest, dressed in a white robe, walks past crowded pews. He stops to hug some parishioners, and then this young boy, maybe 12, takes Father Van Dyl's hand at the front of the church as he addresses the congregation. Right after the sermon, we follow him out into the streets to this small nearby slum. He's distributing soup to the poor. It's something he does pretty much every week. So in the slum, there's this kid. He's probably, again, about 11 or 12. And as he's leaning over to fill up his bowl of soup, Father Jan grabs a lock of the boy's shoulder-length hair. And as the kid tries to wriggle away, Father Jan doesn't let go. For a few steps, he follows the boy, holding his hair almost like a leash. And then he turns to me and says the boy reminds him of another boy who was in his orphanage house back in Rio de Janeiro.
Look at his hair.
He reminds me of a boy who was in my house in Rio de Janeiro.
For more than 2 decades, Father Jan ran an orphanage here. In 2008, the local head of Child Protective Services in Caucaia received a complaint of child molestation against Father Jan. And then 2 former volunteers at the orphanage also accused the priest of sexually abusing some of the orphans. I spoke with the head of Child Protective Services, and he said that they weren't able to follow up on the complaint because of a lack of resources. So back at his church, I sat down with Father Jan myself, and I asked him about all these allegations of abuse.
So in your life, have you ever been sexually attracted to children? Have you ever abused children in any way?
No.
So he said all the accusations against him are lies. They're drummed up by an abusive parent, envious competitors, or naive college students. And when we asked him literally, what does it mean to be a paedophile, he gave us this bizarre answer.
Yeah, literally.
Well, literally, pedophilia comes from the Greek. Pedos meaning child and philia meaning friendship with children.
Philo, amigo.
But people have translated this word as pedosexual.
So you would say, using the real sense of the word...
Yeah.
Yes, in the real sense of the word, I'm a pedophile, but not a pedosexual.
Since our investigation came out this past fall, Father Jan's no longer allowed to celebrate Mass at all. So far, we've heard all about priests being sent to South America after they were accused, but not convicted, of abusing children, despite the evidence against them. But then across the continent, in Peru, we tracked down this case of an admitted child molester who's still a priest and still working with kids.
Hi.
Buenos dias.
I'm good, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
My name's Will Carlos, I'm a reporter with the Global Post.
Back in the 1970s, Father Paul Madden was accused of repeatedly molesting and raping a 13-year-old boy while they were on a mission trip together out of Jackson, Mississippi. He was sued twice by the victim, and in 1994, the diocese agreed to pay the family $50,000, and Madden signed this letter of apology to the victim's parents. The letter said, "I've been plagued with remorse and guilt for my molestation of your son. There is no excuse for my actions, and I assume responsibility for them as a humble penitent." But here, in the small fishing village of Puerto Warme, a few hours north of Lima, Peru, Father Madden was still performing Mass when we caught up with him last year. He's a middle-aged man, originally from Ireland, and he was wearing this crisp white robe with gold trim.
So I guess my first question to you would be, your congregation here in Puerto Warme, are they aware of the allegations that were made against you back in...
No.
They don't know about it?
No.
Do you think they should?
I don't think so, since the case has been dismissed and all the rest of it, you know.
Well, the case was... I understand the second lawsuit was dismissed, but the first lawsuit was settled. And I believe the diocese paid something like $50,000.
That's right.
And I also understand that there was a letter that you wrote to the family, actually admitting the abuse happened and everything else.
Yeah. Well, I didn't write that letter, actually. The lawyers for the diocese wrote it nicely.
Okay. So, I mean, the important thing is whether it happened or not, right?
Something happened. I was drunk. Mm-hmm. And I had never drank before in my life. Mm-hmm. It was the first time ever. And... I woke up in the middle of the night and, something happened.
So in the year or so I spent tracking down these priests, I'd run through every possible scenario for how these confrontations could go. But in all those scenarios that I ran through, I never expected one of them to actually confess.
And it's something that you regret, obviously?
Obviously.
Right.
With that, we tried to interview the bishop of Madden's diocese. He wouldn't talk to us, but his second-in-command, Vicar General Juan Roger Rodriguez, did. Did you know Paul Madden was accused of, admitted to, sexual abuse in the United States?
No,
this is a surprise to us.
You didn't know?
Okay. It's a surprise. To some, it may seem hard, even painful, for a bishop to have to investigate a priest. But it must be done, because there is a greater good, which is truth, and shall we say, the innocence of a minor.
Whether or not Rodriguez followed through with his promise of an investigation isn't actually clear. He stopped taking my calls.
So after hearing that piece, I just wanted to process it a little bit. So we got Will on the line to kind of talk it through. Will, how you doing?
Hi, Al. How you doing?
Good, man. So after listening to that piece and also watching the documentary you made on the same subject, the big question I had is, you know, these are kids, man. I mean, they're kids. Why is there even a question of what to do with these perpetrators?
Right. I mean, as a father of two kids, you know, it's definitely a kind of I have a pretty visceral reaction. And a lot of my friends actually ask me, you know, how do you control yourself? You know, how do you not just unleash yourself at them? And obviously, you know, we're professionals and we spend a lot of time, you know, considering how we're going to do it and planning things out, and we keep our cool. But yeah, there's certainly a part of you that is very mad at these people when you're going into these situations.
So we've heard about this zero tolerance policy throughout the show. The fact that they need the policy is crazy, but are they actually doing it?
Well, honestly, what's even crazier is that it's never been defined actually what that means. So Pope Francis has gone out to every bishop in the world and said, we want you to have this zero tolerance policy. It sounds very good. It gets a lot of headlines. But then he's never actually substantiated what that means. He's never issued actual rules or guidelines about what bishops are supposed to do when they're confronted with a situation like this. And so you get the situation that we have today where these men are allowed to move around the world with impunity and carry on working as priests and carry on working with children day in, day out.
So with Pope Francis coming in, there were high hopes that he was going to be a big reformer and change things. But specifically dealing with this subject, is he getting serious about these priests that are abusing children?
Man, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. You know, I mean, he's set up this commission that's supposed to be advising him on how to proceed and what policies to change. But the bottom line is, if you talk to people who work in this world, and you talk to them and you say, what does this Pope need to do? They say, it's simple. What he needs to do is he needs to go out tomorrow with one swipe of his pen, he needs to make all of the records public, and he needs to make very clear what his zero tolerance policy means, and he could fix this very quickly with minimal effort.
Give me the long view here. I mean, this is something that's been going on for a really long time in the church. Where do we go now? Now that we have all this information about what's happened, you know, what's next?
Well, I think it's impossible to look forwards without looking backwards. And the work done by, you know, the Spotlight team in Boston, by all of these journalists across the decades, there's no doubt that we're looking at a Catholic Church that's in a very different place now than it was before. So we've already had huge strides forwards. I think what we need to see next is to see whether this Pope is going to, frankly, put his money where his mouth is and start making some actual changes that will really tangibly help people moving forward.
That's correspondent Will Carlos of the Global Post. Since this story first aired earlier this year, there's an important update. All of the priests that Will profiled have been dismissed from their positions. You can find a link to his print piece and the documentary where Will hunts down these fugitive fathers at revealnews.org. We want to thank Minnesota Public Radio and the Boston Globe for their help with this show. Our program was edited by Pat Flynn. Ike Sriskandaraja and Michael Schiller were our lead producers. Julia B. Chan and David Richard produce our update shows. Thanks to Michael Paulson and Rob Harris for additional reporting and editing help. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our managing editor is Amy Powell. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story.